Okay, so we are, this week's Parsha coming up is Parsha's Vayichi. It is the last Parsha in Sefer Bereishis, as you know. It starts by telling the story of the last 17 years of Yaakov's life living in Mitzrayim. He ages and wants to bless his Yosef, and he calls Yosef, hears that Yaakov is aging and is nearing death. So Yosef brings his sons for a bracha, and famously Yaakov switches the arms and he gives the primary bracha to the younger one rather than the older one. Yosef objects, but Yaakov insists that that is what he intends to do. So after the bracha, of course, actually just before, Yaakov asks Yosef to ensure that he is buried in Eretz Yisrael. He asks Yosef to swear to that effect. Yosef eventually does. And then he gives the bracha to the children, to Yosef's children. Afterwards, he gives a bracha to all of the children, all of his children, very famous set of brachas. Finally, he passes away, and then he's buried in a very extravagant burial. He's taken to Eretz Yisrael. And then finally, Yosef dies at the relatively young age of 117 years. For us, that's pretty old, but not in those days. And that ends the Sefer Bereishis with the conclusion of the story of the Yaakov and then Yosef. So, as you all know, Yosef was the apple of Yaakov's eye. If Yaakov had a favorite, it's pretty clear that Yosef was Yaakov's favorite. This goes back to the Ksones Pasim, to the special multicolored garment, a sign of love that Yaakov gave Yosef, unlike the other brothers, which of course didn't endear him to the other brothers. But Yosef was his favorite from youth. And that favoritism continues through to Yosef's adulthood, Yaakov's old age, when finally Yaakov gives a special bracha to Yosef's sons and renders them the equivalent of Shvatim. They would have the same status as far as inheriting the land. And it says, Ephraim u'Menashe k'Reuven v'Shimon li. Ephraim and Menashe will be like my own children. They will inherit equal to all of their uncles, in effect. And if you think about it, going back to Yaakov's earliest childhood, he was driven by two goals. One, to achieve the bracha from his father Yitzchak, which he did. And the other, to achieve bechora, the firstborn rights, the rights of the firstborn. Although he was a twin, he was born second. And through his subterfuge, he managed to get Esav to sell the Bechora to Yaakov. So Yaakov got both the Bracha and the Bechora, and it is precisely those two achievements that he transfers to Yosef. He transfers to Yosef the Bracha, which is given to Yosef's own children especially, and the Bechora. Yosef's children receive Pishnayim. The halacha in inheritance is that the Bechor receives double of what other children receive, and that's exactly what he gave to Yosef. Yosef's children receive double, Keruven become Menashe. So clearly, from Yosef's earliest childhood until Yaakov's death, Yosef was the apple of his eye, and this, of course, probably, at least in part, derives from the special feelings that Yaakov had for Yosef's mother, Rachel, who was his beloved wife. They met at the well, love at first sight, always loved her, and that love, after her death, certainly was transferred to Yosef, her Bechor. While that overall picture, I believe, is accurate, there are some, how should I put this, unexpected turns of events which becloud that otherwise clear picture. Things happen which are you wouldn't expect to happen if that picture were completely accurate. And I want to suggest to you that while there is general very considerable truth to that picture. Nevertheless, there are, I would say there's an obfuscation, there's a lack of clarity as well. And the first point I'd like to make is what happens towards the beginning of the parsha when Yaakov asks Yosef to bury him in Mitzrayim. Excuse me, in Eretz Yisrael. So, yeah, let me just find the psukim, because they're important. So Yaakov says at the very beginning of the parsha, Im no matzasi chein beinecha, if I have found favor in your eyes, sim na yadacha tachas yurechi, place your hand under my thigh, which is an ancient mode of expressing a shvua, an oath. V'yasisa imadi chesed ve'emes, and do with me kindness and truth. Al na sikmareni b'mitzrayim, don't bury Mitzrayim. So what would you expect Yosef's response to be? Sure, Abba, I will put my arm underneath your thigh and I will swear. Right? That's what you would expect. But that's not what Yosef does. What Yosef says is, Anochi e'eseh kidvarecha. I will do as you say. Upon which Yaakov says, Hishavali, swear to me. At that second request or insistence, Yosef vayishavalo, Yosef swears, vayishtachavu Yisrael al rosh hamitan. Yaakov Yisrael bows at the head of the bed. So I ask you the following question, and I think it's an obvious one. If beloved dad asks beloved son to swear that he would bury him in Eretz Yisrael, why does Yosef first resist? He just says, I'll do what you say. He doesn't swear. It's only when Yaakov reiterates, Hishavali, no, I want you to swear. Saying, Anochi eseh kedvarecha, I'll do as you say, is not sufficient. I want you to swear. It's only then that Yosef chooses to swear. So why did Yosef resist in the first place? So some Mefarshim say, they suggest, well, Yosef felt it was unseemly for him to put his hand under Yaakov's thigh. Seems a little forced. If that was a standard mode of Shrua and Yaakov asked, so okay, do it. I'm not completely satisfied with that answer. Some say that Yosef did not want to swear because it was not entirely up to him. After all, he had a boss, Paro. And Paro had to approve that plan. And so he felt uncomfortable swearing to that which he could not really completely guarantee, so that he didn't swear. I see Avram Miller suggests Yosef became a bit too comfortable in Egypt. Well, Yosef does say he would follow his father's wishes, so it's not like he's resisting the plan, he's just resisting the swearing in particular. If Yosef swears, and he can't carry out the shvua because Paro resists, well, then he isn't honest. He can just get a heter for the shvua. So I don't see why that should really bind him. So both of these standard explanations, to my mind, at least for me, aren't fully satisfying. I think we need to probe more deeply as to why Yosef resisted complying with his father's dying wishes, and that's what they were, dying wishes. Now, let's track this a little bit further. Yaakov, Yosef comes with his two sons for a bracha, and eventually, Yaakov does give them a bracha. He says, Jews will be blessed through you. May Hashem make you like a place, you like Ephraim v'Chemenasha. And this is the standard bracha that fathers give to their children at the Friday night table. Yisimcha Elohim b'kafayim lechem asher, and yivarecha Hashem v'yishmarecha, and so on and so forth. So that's the bracha that Yaakov gives Ephraim and Menashe. However, look at this pasuk, pasuk Tes Zion. Vayivarech es Yosef, when Yosef first comes with Menashe and Ephraim, the Torah says, this is a few psukim before the pasuk I just read to you, Yaakov blesses Yosef, Vayomer, and he says, Elokim esher eshachu avosai lefanav, the God whose fathers walked before me, Avram Yitzchak and Yitzchak, Elokim aroa osi mi odi ad yom hazeh, Hashem who shepherded me from until this day, Hamalach hagoel osi mi kora, the angel that saved me from all evil, Yivarech esen arim yekar vehem shmei, you should bless these young children and they should call their my name by them, and so on. So there's something weird about this pasuk. It says, Vayivarech es Yosef. He gave a bracha to Yosef. And what's the bracha that he gave? The bracha is to the Na'arim. Yivarech es ha-Na'arim. The Ephraim and Menashe got the bracha. There's something missing there. It says that Hashem, that Yaakov gave Yosef the bracha, but when the pasuk makes explicit what that bracha was, the bracha explicitly is for Ephraim and Menashe. So what happened to Yosef? It says he gave a bracha to Yosef, but the bracha he gave to Yosef was the bracha he gave to Ephraim and Menashe. So what happened to Yosef? Yosef seems to be missing a bracha. So all the Mefarshim asked this question, or not all, but many of the Mefarshim asked this question. The Ramban's answer is, well, if you give children a bracha, that is like giving a parent a bracha. If parents see their children blessed, they themselves feel blessed. That's their bracha. Their bracha is that their children receive a bracha. That's the Ramban's explanation. The Or HaChaim, one of the classical Mefarshim, and they wrote down, included in the Megillas Gedolos, he rejects that. He says, and I really hear the Or HaChaim's point. I sympathize with it. Being a father myself, I mean, it's wonderful for my children to get brachas, but what am I, chopped liver? Like, I want a bracha too. Like, just because Yosef's children got a bracha doesn't mean that Yosef himself wouldn't want a bracha from his holy father, Yaakov Avinu, Ish Kodesh. So the Or HaChaim is unhappy with the Ramban's explanation for exactly that reason. And I really hear that myself personally. So that's one explanation. The Sfarna on that pasuk says, well, Yosef really got a bracha, except that the Torah doesn't stipulate what it was. The only bracha that the Torah makes explicit is the bracha that Yaakov gave Ephraim and Menashe. And the Torah doesn't say what the bracha that Yosef got was from Yaakov. That seems also to be somewhat problematic to my mind. Like, what, if the Torah says all the other brachas, why doesn't the Torah say what the bracha was for Yosef? So I think we have a problematic pasuk here. Yosef, on the one hand, doesn't at first swear to comply to his father's request. Strangeness number one. Strangeness number two, there doesn't seem to be a direct bracha that Yaakov gives Yosef. So, as I said, the overall picture is one of Yosef being the apple of Yaakov's eye, but there are these blips here, these little problems that I think render that overall picture a little more complicated. So, I'd like to suggest that there's more to these episodes that meets the eye, and there's a pattern here. I'm going to try to explain to you what I think that pattern might be. So in order to see that pattern, we need to kind of look at the events in this and other parshios from a helicopter's perspective, from a macro perspective. So let's go back to the very beginning of the parshios Mikes about Yosef. You'll recall that Yosef had these predictive dreams that his brother's father would bow down to him. And he understood that. I think the other brothers understood it that way, and Yaakov understood it that way, is that he dreamt that he would be a melech, and they would be bowing down to him to acknowledge his authority over them, his sovereignty, his malchus. And bowing is this expression of submission to a melech. And at one level, that dream was fulfilled. Because in fact, it did transpire, as we saw in last week's Parsha, that the brothers and Yaakov, in fact, bowed down to Yosef. So the dream, at one level, was juridical. It was a true dream. They actually bowed down to him. However, the caveat is that Yosef never became a melech. He was a mishnah of a melech. He was a viceroy. He was the preeminent number two person, subservient to the number one person, namely Paro. So at one level, his dream was fulfilled, but at another level, in the case of what happened in his own life, the dream was not completely fulfilled. However, if we think about it even more broadly, if we look at the telescopic picture of Jewish history projected in the brachas that Yaakov gives to all of the children, what do we find? To whom does Yaakov bequeath melucha, royalty? Not to Yosef, as I've pointed out the past couple of weeks, but to Yehuda, La Yosser, Shevet Miyehuda, the staff of Malchus, of royalty, of sovereignty, will never be removed from Yehuda. So the ultimate significance of Yosef's childhood dreams was denied by none other than the father who loves him so dearly. And that was in fact confirmed by what transpired in Jewish history. Fundamentally, Yehuda was the melech of Klal Yisrael. There was eventually a civil war and a division in the tribes, but that represented an anomaly. Fundamentally, Yehuda was, and his descendants were Malchei Yisrael. And so Yaakov himself denies to his most beloved son what his most beloved son wanted more than anything else in his dreams. And that was the monarchy, being the leader of Klal Yisrael. In fact, the Abarbanel makes really an interesting point. He says, these brachos that Yaakov gave all of the Shvatim, were they Yaakov's, or were they Yaakov speaking prophetically in the voice of Hashem himself? Who gave these brachas? Did Hashem give these brachas, and Yaakov was a prophet who was merely transmitting the brachas that were not his, but the brachas that were Hashem's? Or are these brachos Yaakov's own brachos, which were in effect affirmed by Hashem, having been incorporated in the Torah? And Abarbanel argues these must be Hashem's brachos. How do I know that? Abarbanel says, because if these were Yaakov's own brachos, guess who would have gotten the monarchy? It would have been Yosef, Yaakov's favorite. So this must be the voice of Hashem that Yaakov is merely transmitting, rather than Yaakov's own predilection, Yaakov's own voice, which is an interesting point, and you could, you know, think about it. But this really brings us to the core question. And the core question is, why in fact did Yehuda, rather than Yosef, achieve monarchy. Especially, let's say, if we take this to be Yaakov's own brachas, which, by the way, I think is the pshat of the Torah. I think the pshat of the Torah is that these are Yaakov's brachas, gathered his sons together. Now, they were divinely inspired, Baruch HaKodesh, and they were affirmed by Hashem in including them in the Torah. But there's something, I think the pshat would be that these are just how Yaakov blessed his sons, his children, sons. So then the question is even more acute, like why is it that Yosef doesn't get it and Yehuda does? So in another part of this very lengthy discussion that Rabbanel makes, what I think is a really penetrating comment, and for the rest of my Devar Torah, I'd like to reflect about it and unpack it. He makes this observation. How does Yaakov in the Brachos describe Yehuda versus how in the Brachos does Yaakov describe Yosef? So, amongst other things, and we're going to focus on a couple of key psukim, Yaakov says about Yehuda that Ata Yoducha Achecha, your brothers will acknowledge you, will thank you, will acknowledge your leadership. How does Yaakov speak of Yosef? Vayistamuhu balei chitzim. The masters of swords arrows hated him. That's, of course, a reference to the brothers whose words against Yosef were like arrows, as the Mefarshim explain. And what Yaakov describes is the animosity that Yosef's brothers had towards him, as we know. And Yaakov further says that, and here's the phrase in the Parsha, Yosef nazir achim. Yosef was like a nazir. He was separated from his brothers. So let's focus on these two utterly disparate and contrary descriptions of Yehuda versus Yosef from Yaakov's mouth, divinely inspired. Yehuda is described as somebody who is acknowledged and accepted by the brothers as Melach. Yosef, on the other hand, is described as a Nazira, as somebody who is estranged and alienated from his brothers, which is the meaning of Nazir, as the Mefarshim say, in this context. Not only that, Vayistamu, they hated him. So what Yaakov is calling attention to is the radical difference between how Yehuda was, how the brothers related to Yehuda, and how the brothers related to Yosef. And that's crucial to leadership. And I'm going to suggest now one way of reading and thinking about that difference. There are other ways, but for now I'm going to stress one. And that difference requires us, now we're in the telescope, so we're going to telescope way, way further into Jewish history to a very famous and really well-known, quite interesting episode in Shmuel Beis. The Aron HaKodesh is being brought to Yerushalayim. David HaMelech, now it's like a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, you know, which of course models after that. You ever see the Simchas Beis HaShoeva in the streets of Brooklyn? There's music is playing, people are dancing. So there was a retinue of people following the Aron Kodesh, contained the Luchos Abris, Holy of Holies, and everybody was dancing wildly. All the young men were dancing, and David HaMelech, the king, joins the Na'arim, the young men, in this wild dancing in the street, mecharker umefazes, very unusual terms, like a kind of a wild, wild, ecstatic dancing. Michal, who observes her husband, Michal being Shaul's daughter, was married to David, one of David's wives, observes David from the window, and she subsequently criticizes him sharply for behavior which is unbecoming a king. As a result of which, she was punished and she remained childless, the Navi reports. So, Michal, daughter of Shaul, David HaMelech, we have two contrary models for the way in which a leader should lead. On the one hand, you have David HaMelech, a man of the people, dancing with the kids, dancing with the Na'aron, right out there, ecstatically celebrating. He's kind of one of the people. He isn't self-conscious about his status as a melech. When it comes to relating to Hashem in ecstasy and davening and singing in gratitude towards Hashem, all trappings of royalty are abandoned, and he just is wrapped up in this ecstasy, this ruchnius of being close to Hashem, irrespective of his status as a melech. Typically, you wouldn't expect a king to go like dancing wildly in the streets, but David did. David was capable, at least al pi pshat, of sinning with Bathsheba, but immediately regretting it and doing the most intense tshuva. There was something authentic, real, present, engaged in David HaMelech. Just a person of incredible kedusha, but able to relate to all those around him unselfconsciously. And that, and of course, Michal was critical of that. But Michal is daughter of Shaul. And Michal is reflecting the approach to the monarchy and melucha of Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech was the polar opposite of David. If you don't mind my using this expression, if there were a central casting in ancient times, Shaul HaMelech would have been the king that central, the actor that central casting sent to act the role of king. As he was perfectly suited in appearance to being a melech. He was tall, he was very, very tall. He was extremely handsome, as he is described in the Navi, very imposing, regal in his bearing. There was something very, very impressive about him. The melucha just shone forth, and he conducted himself with all of the trappings of the royalty which he had acquired. And he was very attached to the symbols of his melucha, and he was had his own narrow circle of advisors. If you look, read the Nach, he didn't hang out with a lot of different people. Didn't have many, many advisors. He had a narrow circle. He ate with them. He dined with them. He took advice from them. But he was not a person of the people. He didn't hang out. The thought of his dancing wildly in the streets is like mind-blowing. It would be Lahavdil, Elif Havdalis, as if Queen Elizabeth started to do a wild jig in front of Buckingham Palace. It was like, you know, it's never going to happen. Because that's just, I mean, you know, a monarch, an aristocrat doesn't behave that way. It's the stiff upper lip. It's the, you know, total control. And that was Shaul's persona. Regal, royal, focused on the symbols and trappings of his melucha. And in order to preserve that melucha, in order to preserve his status, his bearing as melech, he was capable of really cruel behavior. Aside from the fact that he persecuted and tormented David to no end, but look what he did to Novir HaKohanim. You'll recall that David took refuge in the city of Nov, the city of Kohanim. Shaul took them to be traitorous in harboring an enemy of the state, and he viciously slaughtered them all, and they were innocent. They didn't know about this. They were living off in the, you know, they were living off in some little town in Nov, like far away from the machinations of the royal court, and they, you know, they weren't really so attuned to this. Nevertheless, Shaul Mordim b'malchus, he wiped them all out. He was totally focused on his melucha and on keeping his melucha and preventing David from taking it and going to the extremes of even killing a whole city of Kohanim to make sure he kept his melucha. He was very focused on his authority, his kingship, his power, his royalty, his regality, and he refused to accept any compromise. So you have two radically different portraits of two Malchei Yisrael. The first one, Shaul, who was, as we know, rejected as the father of all Malchei Yisrael in favor of David. Now, Shaul was from which Shevet? Shevet Binyamin. Binyamin was the son of Rachel, as was Yosef, the son of Rachel. And my suggestion to you is, if you think about it, there are certain similarities between Shaul and Yosef, both descendants ultimately of the same mother, Rachel, and both very, very different from David, that descendant of Yehuda. Just as Yehuda was Yoducha Achecha, respected and accepted by all of his brothers, Yosef not so. Let's look a little bit more. And Shaul, again, as I say, was separated from Hamonon, wasn't one of the people like David was, confined to his close circle of advisors, would never dance in the streets. Now let's take a look at Yosef. I think there were certain similarities between Shaul and Yosef. I think it's fair to say that there's a certain, maybe aloofness that comes across with Yosef, for example, the way he handled his brothers, which was a brilliant effort to enable them to achieve tshuva, which they did. But nevertheless, he had to kind of like hold him back, held himself back, and manipulate things, which requires a certain remove, a certain aloofness from what they're feeling and what's going on, a very considerable self-restraint. We talked about that. The Gemara in Brachos, Daf Nun Hei Amud Aleph, says, if you look at, but the Gemara in Brachos, Nun Hei Amud Aleph, says that Yosef died before all of his brothers. In that sense, you might say he died prematurely. So the Gemara says, why did Yosef die before all of his brothers? And the Gemara's explanation is he was misnaheg berabbanus. He conducted himself with authority. In other words, he was too, from the Gemara's perspective, he was too bossy. He was too authoritarian in the way he manipulated, handled, moved things around. He lorded it over his brothers and maybe over his father in ways that the Gemara felt uncomfortable with. For which reason, the Gemara says that he died early. Targum Yonasan, one of the Targumim to the Torah, if you have a full set of Chumash with multiple Targumim, Targum Unkelus, one translation into Aramaic, and then there is the Targum Unkelus, Targum Yonasan, another translation into Aramaic. And Targum Yonasan says that the reason he died earlier than his brothers is because he insisted that his father bow down to him. Similar idea, this Rabbanus, this insistent on power and demonstrating that power, which, by the way, we saw with Shaul. Yosef was a person of great kedusha. He was an ish tzaddik. He was a tzaddik. Yosef HaTzaddik, that's how he's called throughout Jewish history. He's an incredibly gifted person with enormous brachas from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that said, he was still misnag berabbanus, according to the Gemara. He still conducted himself with inappropriate bossiness. And that is reminiscent of Shaul HaMelech, of the very same family, this insistence on living out the details of the dream, as Targum Yonasan says, and having his father bow down to him. One wonders if there's a certain... What does it mean when somebody's misnag berabbanus in the language of the Gemara and Brachos? They're bossy. They lack a certain empathy, a certain compassion, a certain awareness of other people, because there's Rabbonis, you know, they're very focused on their authority and their power. It could be that that has something to do with why he refused to swear to his father, initially resisted, swearing to his father that he bury him. Maybe it's because he felt it was unseemly for a person of his elevated authority to stick his hand under his father's thigh. Maybe because he felt that it was inconsistent with his royalty to have to swear. Like, I mean, Dad, you want me to swear? Like, my word is not good enough? After all, Amalek, I have the power. So he may have felt that that request impinged upon the Rabbanus, in the language of the Gemara, upon the authority, the power that he thought he had, and it was he felt it would compromise his power. And, you know, Yosef is described as a person of extraordinary charm. I mean, every one of his bosses becomes his greatest advocate. Starts working, boom, he's in charge, which is very, very impressive. He was extremely good looking, very charming, lots of chayin, as Yaakov says, he had a lot of chayin. But one wonders if that charm and chayin extended not only vertically upwards, but vertically downwards as well. In other words, was it only his superiors who felt the charm and chayin of Yosef? But one wonders if his colleagues, those on the same horizontal plane as he, and those below him, were as charmed by Yosef as those above him. We know his brothers certainly weren't charmed by Yosef. So whatever chayin he had didn't work on them. But consider Yosef's approach to governing Mitzrayim. He seems like a very brisk administrator. He shuffles around populations so that people don't feel ownership over any particular land. He buys everybody's property for Paro. One wonders how compassionate and empathetic those strategies are. I mean, they were very practical and very effective. And that's why he did them, because Yosef was an incredibly talented administrator, amongst many other things, aside from his Kedusha. But do you think that all the subordinates, all those people in Mitzrayim, were happy to be removed from their ancestral homes? And do you think they were happy about selling themselves and their property to Paro and they became slaves? It may have been very, very effective service to Paro the master, but one wonders if the people below him were a little less enthralled by Yosef's charm and gifts than Yosef's superiors. And it seems to me that this is a little bit like Shaul. And I would suggest to you that possibly Yaakov did not want a Yosef model as a monarch of Klal Yisrael. And the Shaul version of that was a failure. What Yaakov wanted for the ultimate melucha of Klal Yisrael is somebody along the Yehuda model, atah yoducha achecha, people, a melech who would be acknowledged and accepted by his population. Somebody who, like David, can dance, can throw off the perks of power and royalty and be one of the guys in worshiping Hashem and feeling that closest to Hashem. Not so worried about, you know, the dress, the scepter, the sword, he can dance in the street. And that's an example of the Atah Yoducha Achicha. And it could very well be that Yaakov, as much as he loved Yosef, and he clearly did, from the very, very beginning, Yosef had Rachel's charm and looks, and he loved her. But Yaakov, in his infinite wisdom, recognized that Yosef HaTzadik, as much as a tzadik as he was, and he was an incalculable tzadik, a great, great man. The model of Malucha that he represented is not what Yaakov wanted for Klal Yisrael and for the long-term future of Bnei Yisrael. He wanted a model of Atal Yoducha, a model of a king who could be mixed with the people, dance with them, be elevated by the quest for Kedusha and closeness to Hashem together with everybody else. So there's a kind of an ironic tragedy here. Yosef was totally focused on the realization of his dreams, which for him were came from Hashem. He was focused on being that person to whom everybody would bow. And that got him through thick and thin, through this being sold and the thrown into prison and the whole thing. Yosef had this vision of a future of greatness, and he pursued it. L'michya shlachani aleichem, he tells the brothers, Hashem sent me for a purpose, and that is to sustain you. I have a role in the long, in the sweep of Jewish history. I have something important to do, that's to support you, to save millions of whoever many there were, citizens, people who lived in the Mitzrayim. He was focused, as I spoke about in the past, his vision, this dream of his future. But it was precisely the focus on that dream in its detail, and the insistence on rulership, sovereignty, monarchy, Rabbanus, bowing down to him, which ultimately was his demise. And so ironically, the very greatness that enabled him to survive and flourish in the most adverse circumstances, that very greatness is what ultimately, from Yaakov's perspective, ruled him out as the long-term model for leadership in Klal Yisrael. So you see how a single character trait can be both extraordinarily helpful and at the same time problematic as well. That's the way it is in life. There are many midos that people have, that we all have, which on the one hand serve us well in certain circumstances, but in other circumstances can be harmful. And I think you see that in Yosef HaTzadik. And so, as much as Yaakov loved him, Yaakov came to understand that a different model of leadership was required. And I think we have something to learn from this. When we think about the changing of the guard in the United States of America, and presidents of the United States who come and go, from Yaakov's perspective, from the Torah's perspective, at least according to this interpretation that I've offered to you, what the Torah advocates and favors, at least according to this interpretation, is not somebody wrapped up in the perks of White House One and hail to the chief, but somebody who knows how to exercise power, but who is beloved by those below him, not only his colleagues, and who can mix with the people, understand them, empathize with them, and who could be Yoducha Achicha, all the citizenry of a country, can acknowledge and respect and desire to be kind of in a room to hang out with that kind of a person. So something to think about when we think about leadership and changes of leadership in our lives, and not only in the United States, but in Israel too. Israel, as you know, is caught in the midst of a very heated and difficult election yet again, 4 times in 2 years. And again, when we think about the kind of leadership that Israel needs, aside from the talents that you expect of a leader, it's worth thinking about the Atal Yoducha Achicha versus the Yosef Nazir Achim. So I just leave this for you to think about. I'm clearly not advocating any one candidate, just talking about one way of thinking about what it is that at least this, my particular reading of the Parsha, suggests about the desiderata of leadership. I see Sharon points out that Moshe seemed to